This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music documentaries. Telling the stories in music that matter. Now. 6 Music Documentaries presents.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. My guest this week is a personal hero of mine and many other music fans. It's Mr. Terry Hall, who, as frontman with the Specials, seemed to represent a kind of detached, dry, cool that was totally at odds with all the other pop stars at the time. He's also a great individual singer, as you heard in that Specials track, Rat Race. After leaving the Specials at the height of their fame in 1981, he went on to form Fun Boy 3 and The Colourfield before embarking on a multifarious career that's seen him work with Damon Albarn and Lily Allen and Sinead O'Connor and leap from style to style in a way that very few artists do or can, all while maintaining this deadpan sense of humour and his own unique vocal style. Terry doesn't normally do many interviews, but here we talk about his early musical loves, growing up in Coventry, the early days and massive success of the Specials, and the infighting and pressures that led him to quit the band. But I started, as I do with all my guests on The First Time, by asking when Terry was first aware of music as a child.
Pinky and Perky, or Torchy the Battery Boy, or Edith Piaf. Yeah, one of the three.
That's a big range of styles.
Yeah. I'll throw Paul Robeson in as well. Well, we had a TV and we had a, what they call stereograms, radio, like a sideboard with the record player in it.
Like a great piece of furniture with the record player inside it.
Yeah. And there were two records. There was Paul Robeson and there was Edith Piaf. That's the only records I remember. And my dad used to play them. Sunday was record day after he'd had a drink. So it was Edith Piaf and Paul Robeson.
Were you fascinated by music even then?
I was fascinated by my dad and his actions, but I think Edith Piaf, yeah. Yeah, but nothing beyond what is this, really.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie.
What about the first piece of music that was yours that you went out and owned? Because that's different to hearing stuff that you folks, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it could have been Fire Brigade by The Move or Johnny Reggae by The Pipkins. It was one of the two. I can never remember. It was maybe late 60s that I started noticing records when I was about 10, 11, around that age. Mm. And by then I'd started listening to my sister's stuff and they were older than me, and they were starting playing reggae and, well, early reggae and soul and stuff and Motown. So I'd become aware of, like, teenagers buying records because my sisters did, and I was approaching teenage. When you're approaching teenage years, do you say teenage years?
I think you say teenage years, yeah.
I was approaching teenage years, 13. So I started looking to buying records then, yeah. But probably The Move, I think. There was like a compilation or a best of or something.
Were you one of these kids that would listen to a record again and again and again and kind of immerse yourself in it?
Yeah, yeah. There was very little to do. I mean, I was quite solitary then and there was very little to do. There was very little on TV that was of any use. And, you know, you had a pencil or a pen and have some paper. Do you know what I mean? That was the extent of what you had in your bedroom. Or a radio or a record player. And my elder sister left home and she put her record player in my room, which meant I could sort of start listening to records. And yeah, that's pretty much all I did from the age of 13 12 13.
Cast your mind back 10 years to the girl who was next to me in school.
Were your musical obsessions at that age then?
Then it got into boys. And David Cassidy, David Essex, around 13, 14.
All the Davids.
All the Davids. Never go wrong with a David. Around 13, 14, I'd started to get into, I don't know, stuff like that, and Roxy Music and T-Rex and that kind of stuff. But I didn't really have any heroes then. The first person I'd guess would probably be David Bowie, another David, but different to David Cassidy. There was a different thing. I remember reading an interview with David Cassidy in Blue Jeans or Jackie, and he refused to do a photo session because he had a spot. And then I thought, that sounded like a brilliant job. It's like, how do you get to do that job where you can refuse because you got a spot? And that was the first time I'd sort of started getting my head around it, really.
Which Bowie track should we play?
From Hunky Dory. I think that was the first one that I had on mass repeat. I'm trying to think of a track of Hunky Dory. Kooks.
Will you stay in a lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. Will you stay in a lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. We bought a lot of things to keep you warm and dry, and a funny old crib on which the paint won't dry. I bought you a pair of shoes, a trumpet you can blow, and a book of rules of what to say to people when they pick on you. 'Cause if you stay with us, you're gonna be pretty cookie too. Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. You ever have to go to school, remember how they messed up this old fool. Don't pick fights with the bullies or the cats, 'cause I'm not much cop at punching other people's dads. And if the homework brings you down, then we'll throw it on the fire and take the car downtown. Will you stay in my lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing.
What was the first gig that you went to that made an impact on you?
It would have been Pink Floyd at Nebworth.
Wow, that's, people normally just say, oh, you know, like Tavares at the local Odeon, but that's a pretty big one to start off with.
I'm not like those sort of people. I'm not sure when it was, 73, 72, around that time, and I couldn't really get my head around it, but I went with a lot of sort of older people, and we went down in a van.
What were the Floyd like?
I was sort of a bit dopey by then, but I remember a flying pig or a rocket or something. That's my memory of that.
What about the first moment when kind of punk hit you? Because that's obviously a moment where all of a sudden music, you're not taking it on board because it's around.
Yeah.
You're taking it on board because it's being directed pretty much at you as someone that age.
Yeah. So many people who formed bands around that time saw the Pistols and the Clash together, and I did in Coventry. And it's, you know, that story, there were 17 people there and everybody formed a band the next day, which pretty much was true. And that was the reason for forming a band, I think, seeing The Clash. But I didn't really like the Pistols' music much. I quite like the Clash. It was sort of a bit more thought out, and I never liked bands like the Damned, and I didn't really get into that kind of. It felt a bit silly to me. And then I saw Patti Smith, 76 or 77.
Wow.
And she was just brilliant. She was just absolutely brilliant. And then Richard Hell. And then I started listening to a lot of stuff, a New York new wave punk, which I really preferred. It just felt a bit more musical, and they were a bit older, and it felt less about how they looked.
What would be a record from New York from that era?
I think Blank Generation by Richard Hell and the Voidoids.
Joined the Specials, because it was shortly after they formed that you kind of joined, 77. Yeah. What were your first impressions of them as a collection of people?
They're all right. They're not kind of people I'd hang around with, but...
What do you mean?
Well, they were a bit dull and lifeless, and I was the youngest member, so at that age, like 17, 18, a gap of 2 years feels like a gap of 10 years, mm-hmm. And so I had my own sort of friends outside of the band, and they did too. And we got on okay. And we were just trying to suss each other out for ages, musically, and what we're all about, really.
Was it quite obvious to you quite early on in those rehearsals that there was something there special?
I think so. I think we did a tour with The Clash, and I think it was that point where we felt like something was happening. Because it was really difficult. It was so easy to get gigs, and... you could get a gig every day, really, around the Midlands, but beyond that, you couldn't really fathom at all, and unless you've got in a van down to London, and we did that a few times and made demos, and it always seemed to end up in the wrong hands, like Pete Waterman.
What?
Yeah, he funded a demo that we had, and then...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he wanted to manage us, and...
Great careers that might not have been.
Yeah, what, his? Yeah, we'd known Pete for ages, since like the early 70s. He used to DJ at Locarno in Coventry. He came to a rehearsal and he said that I need to project more. I remember this. And he said, what you need is you need to wear black and then something on top of the black, like a piece of metal or gold or something, to draw people in. And Yeah, cheers, Pete. See you in a bit.
Which is why you took to wearing a giant gold medallion for the rest of your career.
I've got one on now.
When Gangsters came out, first special single, was there that moment when, rather than just doing it for your friends, doing it for certain people, you think, I'm connecting with people who maybe aren't part of my scene, that maybe people aren't necessarily ska fans or reggae fans, we're touching somebody, we're touching a new audience?
Not really.
It was a big single, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and it was a big hit, but even at that point, I couldn't work out what we were doing it for. I knew what we were doing it for, but I couldn't work out where we were going to go with it or what was going to happen, or it didn't feel like it was going to last forever or 5 minutes, or you're just so immersed in it, you just sort of got on with it. And the size of the band became apparent when we started touring abroad, really. And and here, even with Top of the Pops, we still lived the sort of same sort of life, so it day-to-day, it didn't really change. You get recognised a bit more, but that was the only difference.
Because when Ghost Town came out, went to number one, you became instantly recognisable as a group and as an individual. I mean, you don't strike me as the kind of person that would really find that showbiz jazz hands, gold medallion thing particularly a comfortable place to occupy, but I guess it was kind of foisted upon you, wasn't it?
No choice, really, and it depends on how you deal with it, I think. It's like, for ages I used to think, when people used to come up to me and I used to say, well, we're the same, really, we're the same under the skin, and then I thought, well, no, I'm not. I'm sort of much more talented than you, and better looking, and everything, really. And from that point on, I could handle it a lot easier.
A lot of the specials material is politicised. The whole idea of the band was kind of politicised. Yeah. When did you, as a kind of young man, start being aware of social issues, injustice, which is kind of... Because it's threaded throughout your work later on as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think when I was sort of 15, 16, and I was asked to leave school because, we were playing up and we were messing about a bit, but... we weren't invited to take any exams, and they fed us out to sort of markets and stuff to do, I think, a work experience where we'd earn £10 a week, which was a lot of money then, but realised that you know, somebody had given up on you already, and you were like 15. And
what, so you couldn't do your exams? It was out?
Yeah, we were out, and we were expelled. And it felt like, okay, you're earning 10 quid a week working on a market stall, but that this thing that was meant to look after you had given up on you, and that's when I first became aware, really.
And that's something that's remained as a thread throughout lots of your stuff.
I think so. People who give up on me.
just know one about. I wander home and all the lights are out. I keep wondering, where did you get that blank expression on your face? Where did you get that blank expression on your face?
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Terry Hall. And that's Blank Expression by The Specials, the band he'd leave in 1981 at the very height of their fame. When did you first think, I've gone as far with The Specials as I can? Was there a moment you can remember just thinking, and I'm done?
When we were hitting each other at in Top of the Pops, that was a sign.
As I was breaking his jaw, I thought, maybe I can't work with this guy.
That was the sign, yeah. But it got really out of hand, and we really didn't get on at all.
Why do you think that is, though? Because, you know, it's if you're going through a process like becoming successful and, you know, getting recognition and working creatively well, the only other people that can understand what it's like are the other people in the band.
Yeah.
So it should, in theory, kind of...
But we were from very different backgrounds, I think, and they became a lot clearer with more success. People would tend to do this with their money or that with their money, and you'd sort of, you had no real common interests. And then you were sort of forcing yourself to be together a lot, which, you know, you go on an American tour, which we did, and that was an absolute nightmare. And you're forcing yourself to be on a bus with people day in, day out, and you don't really like them. They don't like you, and it's really hard. I just felt like I was the only person who could see the problems, and everybody else was just content with getting on with it, but I wasn't. I just didn't want to live like that.
Can you remember making that phone call or closing that door in the rehearsal studio and just thinking, I cannot be arsed with this anymore?
Yeah, and telling the rest of the band. It was difficult because I never felt like I owe anybody a living, or do you know what I mean? You're in it and this is what you do, but when their record company worked out how much revenue they were going to lose, and they were trying to offer me money to stay with the band, I just thought, this is so horrible, and almost, not bribed, but just weird. And it was hard to tell the band, but by that time, I'd sort of worked out that me and Linval and Neville were going to form another band.
Mm.
The only reason to form that band was as a reaction to The Specials, and we just wanted to get out of one environment that felt really nasty and not good. It's something else that, you know, maybe you could have a bit of a laugh, and that was the reason for forming that band.
Starvation, but I just cannot see the point. gathered here today. All that no one wants to take away.
I was listening to The Lunatics Have Taken Over the Asylum, the first Fumble 3 record, which is still a great sounding track. I hadn't heard it for a while. And it was different to what people were going to expect. It was maybe more pop. Was there a feeling of consciously, I will do this in a totally different way to how it's been before?
Yeah, and we said, let's leave instruments at the door. Let's just hire some stuff in when we get into a studio, like a percussion box, and if there's a piano, let's play that. And
is that how it works?
Yeah, right, okay. And so we got into a studio. We told our record company that we had an album's worth of material and you've probably got 10 hits there, and we didn't have one thing. But they were like, great, great, get on with it. And so we just sat in a room for best part of a year and, you know, made this record, and with whatever was around, really. And people, and Bananarama came in and played on it, and yeah.
With the Colourfield, if their first album, 1985.
Yeah.
Bobby Goldsborough, you've said, was the inspiration for that band. I'd never heard of him. I don't know a lot about him.
At that point, I had all these names and faces, like Bobby Goldsborough and Terry Jacks and Jack Jones and Andy Williams, that were in my head, but you'd never really listen to them because they didn't come into my circle. But at the end of the Funboy 3, everything had got so loud again and so brash. And
the
so
instruments had come back.
Instruments, and the record company was louder then, demanding, and so it was time to end that, and I wanted a quieter time, so I moved into the country, and that was my first breakdown. That was my first breakdown. And
what happened?
I just had a mental breakdown, and I refused to take my duffel coat off for 18 months, but that was quite good. It was a bit indie, Glasgow, pastels-y, keep your hood up, so it's quite good. But so I just wanted to get quieter, so I started the band with Toby Lyons, and we sort of went back and started to listen to a lot of what would be called easy listening, and I got really obsessed with it, and the look, and all of a sudden you could go to Austin Reed and buy an outfit and look like David Hunter from Crossroads, or do you know what I mean? And like people were like, overlooked that, I thought, they overlooked that look, and everything just felt a bit grown up, and you didn't really have to race anymore, and you weren't part of this thing anymore where you had to get hit records, and if you choose not to, and that's why I chose that.
What would be the track, maybe the Bobby Goldsborough track or the Andy Williams track, that would sum up where you were at that point?
I think it'd be Terry Jacks and Seasons in the Sun.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Think of me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the hills that we climbed were just seasons out of time. Goodbye, Papa, please pray for me. I was the black sheep of the family. You tried to teach me right from wrong. Too much wine and too much song. Wonder how I got along. Goodbye, Papa, it's hard to die when all the birds
see them, I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the wine and the song, like the seasons have all gone. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the wine and the song, like the seasons have all gone. Goodbye, Michelle, my little one. Gave me love and helped me find the sun. And every time that I was down, you would always come around and get my feet back on the ground. Goodbye, Michelle, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, with the flowers seasons in the sun, but the stars we could reach put your starfish on the beach.
So do you feel this kind of pull and push away from maybe music, but also the wider music industry and being, you know, in the media doing stuff like this? Do you find yourself like...
I'm okay as long as I feel like I'm in control of stuff. And that's not about being like the control freak, because I'm not at all, but... For my own sanity, really, being in control of stuff just generally is a much better thing. And it's the same with gigs now. You know, when we tour now as the Specials, we don't feel like we're a part of the music business. We're just this own, our own little entity, really, who can just play it or not. You know, it's it doesn't feel like a pressure.
When did you first meet Damon Albarn? Because he's someone else you've done a lot of work with. You did the Hour of Two Lights album for his Honest John label,
yeah.
Which is a really interesting record.
I think so. I met Damon in a pie and mash shop in the East End. No, not really. I can't remember. It's just like a mutual respect, I think, with me and Damon. I really like early Blur stuff, and we bumped into each other one day and we just started talking, and, you know, he was a fan of Specials and the Funboy 3. Then you just sort of hang out a bit.
Because that Hour of Two Lights album, it's, you kind of drew from Middle Eastern and... North African and Eastern European influences. That
yeah.
And it's lovely. It's completely surprised to lots of people.
Yeah.
It's not something like you'd done before.
No. But I think that's the beauty of, you know, sort of being your own boss. You can sort of change direction. You can do things. You can try things out. It's like you sometimes read about bands who go on to make their third album and there's a massive shift here and there's a new direction. And there's a violin on it. That's the addition. And I think it's such a wasted opportunity. And, you know, why not try all these... If you get a thought, try it out. And I sort of stand by that. And, I've never gone out for commercial success. And if you've got that in your head, you're all right. It's EMI once said that every time I made a record, I committed commercial suicide. I thought it was fantastic. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Cheers.
Damon theme and the collaboration theme, the Gorillaz track you did as well with D12 and
yeah,
Gorillaz.
Yeah.
9/11, very political track again. How did you come to work with them? Was that just a...
was just through Damon.
Just Damon connection.
Well, Damon was putting together different people for his records, really. And I think that's why I quite like what he does so much, because he actually does change direction, you know, to go from Blur to Gorillaz and stuff. It is quite a leap, really, and then do an opera or something. He gets on with it and he tries stuff out, which is really good. They did a gig in New York with D12, and Damon said, "Will I come over to sing with them?" And I thought, "Well, it's a long way for two songs, but maybe it'd be good." And then I went over, and then I sat behind his screen, And then there was no order. I thought, what? Why did he ask me to come? It was so weird. It's like, it's good fun, though.
When did you first think it was time to get the Specials back together again? Question you have been asked many, probably more times than any other question in the past couple of years.
It is honestly linked to me getting better. I got ill again about 6 or 7 years ago, and I started on some medication, which was really good and really sort of made me want to do stuff. I started thinking about people I'd worked with and people I'd knew. And then I thought about people like Brad, our drummer, and Linval, who I've really got on with, okay, you know. And then we didn't see each other for 20 years. And I thought that was really, let's just get back and say hello and how are you doing? And just to meet up. So we did that. We arranged a meeting with all of us, all seven of us. And it was just interesting to see how people had changed or not, or who we got on with. And that we decided then at that meeting to try rehearsal. And originally, I think it was for, was it Roger Daltrey who wanted us to do the Teenage Cancer thing?
Yeah, the big things that they do at the Albert Hall.
And that was going on in my head and thinking, well, maybe we could get back together and do that. And that'd be really brilliant. And so we tried a rehearsal and it became apparent that we wanted to do something, but we didn't know what, really. But it was to gig.
Because it's the thing, I mean, the weight of expectation for something like that, as has been, Blur felt it, I'm sure the Stone Roses felt it, it's this idea that it's fine to get back together, but you can't go out as a covers band of your own material, and you can't go out anything less.
No.
Because you're messing with people's lives, people's musical memories, and things that soundtrack their childhood or their youth. I mean, that must have been, that's a difficult thing to face up to.
Well, it was until I saw the Pixies reforming and playing at Brixton, and I thought they did it brilliantly, and they just sort of turned up and got on with it, and there was nothing great going on apart from their stuff. And then I saw, I think, Patti Smith doing something, and people were starting to do their old stuff, and it didn't feel bad and it didn't feel shallow. It just felt like some sort of celebration. And you know, when we did our first gig in, I think it was in Newcastle, it just felt like a real celebration of something. And it was hard to work out what it was, but there was a definite connection between the band and the audience, and we'd grown up together or something. And it was such a really lovely feeling.
It's good to be wise when you're young, 'cause you can only be young but for once. Enjoy yourself and have lots of fun. So good at life, my friend, that it's never done. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
Still in the pink, the years go by as
And obviously it felt good enough to keep on doing.
Well, yeah, we've done about 1,000 dates or something. We started off wanting to do like a handful, but it's just went really well, and it felt like people really wanted to see us. And if that happens, then you do it, I think.
Is there the desire to go back into the studio at all?
There hasn't been.
You must have talked about it. You must have nipped in to try something.
No, I've never done that. I thought you were going to say jam then. Never do that. But you can do. I mean, it's like getting your head around the music business, how it is now. I mean, it's so different to how it was when we, you know, first time round for us. And do you want to get involved in this and that? I don't know. But never say never, but we've come to a natural pause now where we've played pretty much everywhere. And so we're just having a pause now and just seeing what's good to do next, if anything.
What about you? What else are you up to?
I've started writing again, which is good, because I've stopped taking my nighttime medication, which is really good, which means I can get up and work again. Just writing songs again, because that's what you do, really. Because we got so busy for 3 or 4 years, there hasn't really been that sort of downtime where you can breathe and think about, you know, you've got a clear 6 months ahead, what do you want to do? And this is the first time it's happened, really. So, yeah, write and paint. I've started painting as a form of therapy. And again, it's another tool to communicate with people. And because I find it really difficult sometimes to communicate and tell people how I feel. I feel I can do that much easier through a song or through a painting or, you know, whatever.
Why is it harder for you, do you think?
I don't know, but it is. And I think why does it have to be your voice that does it sometimes? What, can't you make something out of clay and say, this is how I feel, rather than trying to explain it and not getting anywhere with that? That's a good point, actually. I must get some clay. I must get clay.
We've had all these firsts, and we're going to finish on the last. It's the last song. You get to choose the last song that we'll play.
I think about the last song I heard was actually last night, and I was in bed, and it was Jeff Buckley, Grace.
That's a fine song to finish the show on.
Yeah.
Thank you for speaking to us, man.
You're welcome.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Oh,
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Hello, this is a shorter version of a weekly new music playlist titled Handpicked by 6 Music, one of a big collection of music playlists you can now download and subscribe to in the BBC Sounds app. To find the full version, just search Handpicked and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.